This is the 137th Psalm, which most of you are familiar with and probably sing. This mizmor is clearly after the Churban. And the only questions we have about when this was written was whether or not this was written in the beginning of the exile in Babylonia or towards the end. In 597 BCE, the king of Israel, Jehoiachin, was exiled along with his entire court, the intelligentsia, and about 10,000 high and mighties, if you might say. The upper crust of Israeli society was taken to Babylonia. He was not tortured. He was actually put into a bit of a palace, but he was under what we would call house arrest. And in a sense, he was being kept hostage. The Babylonians did not impose their language or their religion on us at that point. That was not the way they wanted. They instead took over the entire area and, in fact, controlled all of what we would call today Mesopotamia. They control the economy only in the sense that they have their tax collectors, but the economy is essentially agrarian in style. There had been a mercantile class in the days of Shlomo HaMelech and thereon, but that's more or less at this point defunct. So they are allowing the peasantry to continue growing food, raising their sheep and their cattle, living a relatively hard scrabble life, and they have to give a certain proportion of their proceeds to the throne. And the main issue is that the coastline, which is out to the Mediterranean, is now under the control of the Babylonians. So they now rule over the entire Fertile Crescent. They've taken over Assyria, which had been in ascendance earlier, and they literally rule the entire area that we would think of from the Indian Ocean to the Nile. That is all under their gigantic empire. Now, Babylonia had once been ruled by the Assyrians, and the Assyrians were a bit more harsh in their control by taking people away from their homelands, shifting them around so that they would not have any kind of loyalty to what they saw as their fatherland. And they would do that sort of thing, and they were a bit more ruthless in demanding control of language and so on. The Babylonians were not nearly as, if you like, imperialistic. They were not that imperialistic. During this entire time from before Jehoiachin through the destruction which occurs in 586, so by your math you can see that it's a little over 12 years. So there's 12 years from the beginning to the end. The prophet at the time is Yirmiyahu. Not everybody feels that we should submit. There are haaretz, there are zealots. And Yirmiyahu tells them to submit, to bend their necks. This is God's will. It will go on, and you need to take it as it is and count your lucky stars, as it were. There are members led by the royal family that view this as treason, and they ultimately foment a rebellion. That rebellion leads to a ruthless crushing, which leads to the burning of the Beit HaMikdash. It leads to the forced exile of almost the entire population. There is still a small amount that are left in Israel, but in a few short years, they too will be either killed or destroyed. That crushing came with a horrific massacre in which they killed men, women, and children without without any discrimination. The idea was to have a reign of terror and prevent this from ever happening again, both by them and by the surrounding nations. Because on the east side of the Jordan, we have other nations. We have Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Edom is in the area that we would think of as Transjordan today. And they, the hordes of Babylonians, have crossed their territory to go to Eretz Yisrael. You need to understand they weren't particularly interested in the desert area. They were interested in that coastline, that entire coastline, which gave them dominion on all shipping, on all mercantile activity, from the eastern world to what was then the beginning of the western world. You understand? That was their major control, and that was their power. And their power was, of course, not merely a military power, it was a military power to make them very, very rich. And that's essentially what happened. At that point, they destroyed, burned, pillaged, and also took from the land of Israel all of our riches. The beautiful stuff that we had in the Beit HaMikdash was all taken to Babylonia. Not long afterwards, you have the story of Esther. This is already towards the latter part of the Babylonian exile. And the Babylonian exile was supposed to take 70 years. That's what the prophet had told them, remember? And we have a reign now of Paras Umadai, because Babylonia has been crushed. And instead, one of its vassal states, Persia, has risen. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. Together with collusion of the Madaim. You need to understand that you've got a bunch of tribes here. What will happen is Ahasuerus, it thinks that the 70 years have come and gone, because he's beginning to count them not from the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the final exile. He's counting the 70 years from 597, which was the time when Jehoiachin and our full our sovereignty was removed. That's what he is counting it. And therefore, he made that mistake. You understand? He was celebrating, when it says that he was celebrating his reign. Now, you remember that Vashti is the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the one that actually destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. So there is a marriage, a political marriage of convenience. He, Ahasuerus, was not to royal born. He was a general who helped win, and he had come from the Medians. And what he did was he married Vashti. She was actually queen, and he became prince consort. Upon her destruction, when they killed her and got rid of her, he became all-powerful king. But he would not last long, because after him, Persians will rise up against him, and you will have the reign, ultimately, of Koresh, otherwise known as Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great was even greater than Alexander the Great, because while in Ahasuerus you heard that the empire reigned from Hodu at Kush, right, from India to Ethiopia, and you take that gigantic crescent all the way across, going this way, Cyrus the Great actually managed to make it through Turkey into what we would think of as almost those, you know, almost Rome. Almost Rome. It became, and that's when you end up having those incredible wars between the Greeks and the Persians. So, in fact, his empire was greater in wealth and in property. And it was this Koresh that had been predicted 140 years prior by none other than Yeshayahu, who said that he would be the Mashiach. Mashiach means the anointed one. That God had chosen him before he was born and called by name. Those who believe that this is a hoax, of course, need to argue that those chapters were written after the fact. And that's why they talk about Isaiah 1, Isaiah 2, and some even have Isaiah 3. Okay? Because how could you have predicted this so many years ahead of time? Koresh is told by the Jews that he's the one that God had chosen, and that God had also chosen him to let the Jews go back to their homeland and rebuild their own country and their temple. Mm-hmm. So it's in his days we hear about Koresh in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, where only a handful of Jews chose to leave Babel and resettle Eretz Yisrael. They began to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Initially, it was built of wood. And those that came, they were horribly disappointed because their memories and what they'd heard about Solomon's temple was like, this is it. Well, that was the initial version, and then it was stopped. The construction was stopped midway because of the Kutim. Mm-hmm. The Kutim had been settled in Eretz Yisrael by the Assyrian Empire in the north that had conquered it a good 200 years prior. And they, along with the Edomites and anybody else that was left over, were worried about the Jews coming back to resettle. So they did their best to try to besmirch the Jews to Cyrus and told him that they're actually fomenting a rebellion and they're not going to be loyal subjects and blah, 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 blah. And of course it was stopped for a short while and then it was resumed. Only in the final analysis, 20% of the Jews that had were settled throughout the lands of the Persian Empire, that includes China, India, Persia, all of these Jews, only 20% made Aliyah, and that became what we think of as the Second Commonwealth, and ultimately Beit Sheni. Beit Sheni was ultimately built not of the wood, the original version one. They did build a stone one once they were well to do enough and independent enough to do so. And it didn't take, of course, long in the eyes of history, just about 200 years later when the Romans began to, first the Greeks and then the Romans, and the rest is history, right? Until we get to 70 AD when the second Beit was destroyed. That second Beit that was destroyed, that magnificent Beit, was the one that was expanded upon and embellished by none other than Holdus, otherwise known as Herod, who was an Edomite. And you're going to soon see a lot of this stuff coming about, where this is coming from. Therefore, most of the Rishonim, Rashi for example, says that this was composed in the beginning of Galut Babel. You will notice that there's no author mentioned. No matter. This is one of those mizmorim that are called yetomim. They're orphans. Nobody says who wrote them. Radak argues that this was written by one of the Levim who yearned for Beit HaMikdash, who yearned for a return to the Avodah in Beit HaMikdash, to their music, to their singing, and so on. And he too sees this as being relatively early within the 70 years of Galut. Mitzudat David is the only one among these classic Mefarshim that says this was written by David prophetically, as if he were there and writing it in past tense, seeing it unfolding and writing it in those forms. Malbim takes a different position. He believes that this was written at the end of the 70 years. And I will tell you what his argument is based on as we begin to learn inside. Al Naharot Babel. Now you need to understand that the Babylonian plains lay between two mighty rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, to this day. And there is a gigantic plain that to some degree goes downward. In other words, the one near the Euphrates is higher sea level than the one in the Tigris. But betwixt and between is relatively arid land. So though they have these two gigantic, mighty rivers flowing between them, the plains there can only be fruitful if you can take that water and transfer it. We know today that Al-Naharot Bavel does not refer, which river are we talking about? The Euphrates? Yechezkel speaks about the Galut that lived in a place called Tel Aviv, Al-Nahar Kvar. So in case you think that Tel Aviv is the city that was built in this past century on the shores of the Mediterranean, you're mistaken. It was chosen Dafka because of the name, that was where the Jews in exile built a city on Nahar Kvar, on what looks like the river, because the word Nahar means a river. But Nahar Kvar is one of the large man-made tributaries that comes from the Euphrates. And that's why there's a multiple Neharot. Okay? Now, according to the Medrash, the exiles, and now we're not talking about 597, we're talking about after 586. Okay? We're talking about 12, anywhere to 12 to 15 to 20 years later, were brought there and they marched through the desert, which was a hot and dry place. And when they finally arrived, they arrived to Naharot Bavel, where they could quench their thirst. Radak u'mitzudot simply say a different approach. They say that the Jews were put into various cities, and they would try to go out near the waters, where they could be near nature, and away from ears of the Babylonians, where they could mourn the loss of their sovereignty, the loss of their countries, and the loss of the Beit HaMikdash. What modern historians tell us is that the first exile, 597, which BCE, which included some of the intelligentsia and the court and the Kohanim and the Levi'im, and of course Jehoiachin and his entire family, that they didn't live it up, but rather that they were humiliated by being forced to both dig and dredge the canals. A classic problem over the years of irrigation in Mesopotamia, the rush of that water that went southward and then spilled into the Tigris, and it would drag with it, and they always had major floods, it would drag with it a lot of earth and silt and salt, so that waters needed to be desalinated and they needed to be dredged to get the sand and everything out of it to keep the things flowing. And that they used to use what they call corvée labor. Corvée labor means labor in which people paid their taxes by giving a certain number of days a month for public service. You understand? But people who were not citizens, those that were exiled, were compelled to do this labor even more so. But it was humiliating to this higher class. And that's why it was Al-Naharot Bavel, Sham Yashavnu, Gam Bachinu. And now we have an issue. The word Sham means there, which implies that the person who writes this is no longer there. Therefore, to say Po Yashavnu, not Sham Yashavnu. That's why the Malbim argues that this is not written in the beginning of the exile, but it is written towards the end of the exile by somebody who's on his way back to Eretz Yisrael, who is recalling what happened in Bavel. And he says, interestingly, not Garnu, but Yashavnu. And he tells us as follows. He says, when they first came, and we read this, by the way, in the 29th, I think it's the 29th chapter of Yirmiyahu, the first exiles wrote letters back to Israel and said, what should we do here? How long will we be here? And Yirmiyahu told them, you're not coming back this generation. And probably not the next generation. Because if you do the max, do the math of 70 years, and the generation is an average of 20 years. And he told them, he says, plant trees, plant your fields, build lives, build homes. You ain't coming home that quickly. Some took it to a very extreme. You see, the Babylonians, as I told you, were relatively liberal. As long as you were a loyal citizen, you could have your own language. You could have your own. And you know this from the book of from Esther, that they spoke their own languages, and there was a whole bunch of religions, and there was a whole, no problem, we're very multicultural, okay? As long as you know, pay your taxes, and you understand where your loyalty lies. The Jews settled and granted that there was some humiliation, certainly by the power structure to be reduced to laborers, but those that came later on in 586 and afterwards settled in. What do you do with the Gullahs? You do make the best of it. So you build homes and you become merchants and you do what you need to do. And it began to become very comfortable. And the Malbim tells us they didn't just live there and see themselves as Gerim be'eretz nochriya, as strangers in a strange land. They saw themselves as citizens, Babylonian citizens of the Jewish persuasion. Gam bachenu. Though we settled there, gam, which is very strange, you don't need the word gam, just say v'bachenu. Though we were settled there, and though we became citizens there, and though we prospered there, nevertheless we continue to cry for the Churban. You know the very famous story about Napoleon, who had a lot of Jews in his army, and they came Tisha B'Av along, and he sees them crying. What are you guys crying about? Oh, well, in this year we lost, and the year before, you know, and then a couple of thousand years earlier than that, we lost the Beit HaMikdash, and we mourn to this day. And he says, people that continue to mourn the loss of their sovereignty and their homeland and the Beit HaMikdash will one day get it back. So the Malbim tells us that the Gam in this respect stands for, nevertheless, we cried. There we settled. But nevertheless, we cried, Bezochreinu et Zion, when we remembered Zion. And the Malbim points out that irony about the word Zion, because the word Tzia means arid, dry. Whereas Babylonia was full of these canals and flanked on both sides by these mighty rivers. So unlike the land of Babylonia, or unlike the land of Egypt, which was fed by the Nile and all of its canals and tributaries that came out of it, the land of Eretz Israel always had to look to God for rain, because it did not have a sufficient natural source of water short of the gift that came from heaven. So though this land was rich, and though it was a geshmak golos, it was not bad. We liked it. We built homes. We had it good. Nobody persecuted. Nobody killed us. You know, Haman came along finally and wanted to do that. You understand? Because every time we got too little, too comfortable, God arouses the Amalekites against us in case we forget. However, at this point, they did not forget. He says, V'gam b'chenu, b'zochenu et Zion, and he says that the word Zion is a double entendre, even as we remembered this dry, arid, hot land. So it's both Zion, as the name of our Zion, of course, is Zion, as well as Yerushalayim. You'll soon see that he changes and speaks about Yerushalayim. It's another name for Yerushalayim. Al aravim betocha talinu kinorotenu. Aravim is willow trees, poplars, which grow near the waters, and they're called weeping willows. On the willows we hung up our lyres or harps, because they wanted to go near the water to play it, but somehow they couldn't. Somehow they just couldn't make themselves sing. They were crying too much. So how appropriate that they took the sources of their music and hung it up on the weeping willows. But the Malbim looks at the double entendre of the word arev, and the word arev means tasty, pleasant, comfortable. And what he argues is, again, back to his notion earlier, he says, though we had all of these pleasures there, all of the comforts of it, nevertheless, we hung up our harps. We could not sing the way we had sung in previous places. Why? Ki sham sha'alunu shovenu. You can't miss the alliteration. Sham sha'alunu shovenu. There, our captors asked us, divrei shir. Give us words of your poetry. Tell us the words of your songs. Vetolelenu simcha. And now we have a big problem about the word tolelenu. If it comes, do you see this way it looks like the word talinu? Mm-hmm. Tolelenu. Some argue that taf and shin are interchangeable between Aramaic and Hebrew. Sholelenu. Shalal is booty takers. Shalal is booty, loot. Those that looted us, asked us. There our captors asked us for song. Give us the words of your song. And our looters, happiness. In other words, they mocked them. They saw them crying and said, why don't you sing? Why aren't you happy? And so there is the lead here. Tolelenu asked us for words of happiness. And then comes the quotation. What were their actual words? Shiru lanu mishir Tzion. Sing for us the songs of Tzion. Sing for us the songs you sang at Beit HaMikdash. So that is for those who we treat the word tolelenu as sholelenu. Rashi disagrees. He says it is not the Aramaic form, shin, interchangeable with taf. Rather, it comes from the word holelenu. Halel is praise. Holelus is wild, mocking revelry. Tolelenu means our mockers. Our mockers asked us, happy, be happy, sing for us the songs of Zion. Reminiscent of the Nazis who asked them to sing, dance, forcing them to dance before they killed them. And that is what is being described here according to Rashi. They're mocking us, they're making fools of us. And that's what the word means, tolelenu. He tells us, Rashi, in the name of Menachem, that tolelenu is a verb, is a noun, our tolelim, which is referring to the kinorot. Remember it said that they hung up their kinorot? So he says, they asked us for words of song and for your musical instruments to make us happy, and therefore tolelenu is our musical instruments. Mm-hmm. But Rashi disagrees with that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Radak says no. It comes from the word yelala. And a yelala is a cry of pain, an ululation. Oi, oi. And therefore it says, they asked us for words of songs, and in the place of our groans and cries and sighs, we should be happy. Shiru lanu mishir Tzion. Sing for us. And that would become extremely ironic and sarcastic. But the Malbim disagrees. The Malbim says, look at the word lanu, sing for us. The same way that you had songs for Tzion, for Yerushalayim, sing for us, for Babylonia. Mm-hmm. You guys are songsters, you're minstrels. This is your country now. Forget it. The anthem that you should be singing is the national anthem here. You should be singing for us. Same way that you sang the songs of Zion, you should be singing now Deutschland über alles. Or may I say, the American anthem. We get very starry-eyed. I don't know about you. I get teary-eyed. God bless America, right? It's a Geschmack Golus. It's an Eretz Chesed. And we do have a certain measure of gratitude, don't we? So we should sing these songs. A golden medina. Instead, what did we say? Eich nashir et shir Hashem al admat necha. How can we sing the songs of God al admat necha? Now, that answer would defy, it would seem on the surface, Malbim's take, because their question was not how can we sing on alien land, but how can we sing the songs of God in alien land? You understand? Mm-hmm. However, I just chose not the Star Spangled Banner, but God Bless America. If the purpose was to take the religious songs and say, Judaism is no longer a nation, Judaism is a religion, then you would argue that you can sing the song of God on any land. But their argument is, Eich nashir et shir Hashem al admat nechar. And they didn't say Eretz, but they talk about Adama, the soil. And the word of alien soil is it's the soil of an alien nation or an alien god. A place which is not holy. How can one sing it? But then comes a song. And that song is a song. We sing it as a song. But for them, it wasn't a song. For them, it was an oath / curse. The word im, if, is an if and the then, in this case, follows. Sometimes it doesn't. It's just if. If I should do such and such, and it's left three dots for your imagination to imagine where it's going. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim. Please notice they're not addressing their captors. They're not addressing one another. Instead, they're speaking to Yerushalayim itself. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I should forget you, Yerushalayim, tishkach yemini, my right hand shall forget. Forget what? Now, in English, they say my right hand shall wither. What are they doing with it?
Forget its skill.
Forget its skill. That's right. Why? Because they used to play
the harp.
Mm-hmm. And then it continues. Tidbak lishoni lichi, may my tongue cleave to its palate dry. You know that when you're under tremendous stress and your mouth gets completely dry and you can't get a word out of your mouth. Im lo eskerechi, if I will not remember you. Remember, there's two words here. Lo tishkach, veliskor. And liskor is how? We know this from Amalek. Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek. Zachor et yom ha-shabbat. Lo tishkach. Lo tishkach is a mental activity. Zachor is bapeh, with the mouth. Points out Elchanan Samet beautifully. That if one were to have chas v'shalom a stroke, And the stroke should affect on the left side of the brain, and it should affect the right side, and the right side should not be able to function. What else would have be affected at that time because it's from here?
Speech.
Speech. So the right hand and speech go together. Im lo alet Yerushalayim, if I should not put Yerushalayim higher than any of my happinesses. Al rosh simchati. The Levim refused to pay. Rashi actually says that they tried to compel them to play. They bit off their thumbs. And he quotes this from Kiddushin. They did it with their teeth so that they would not be able to play. But Elchanan Samet presents a different position in Al Pi Haloche, and he simply quotes it. We build a house and we leave a patch unpainted. Because what makes a person happy? Building a new home. We make a wedding and we break the glass. Zecher HaChurban. And it continues. And the Chosen, at his height, puts ashes on the place of the Tfilin. We don't forget Yerushalayim. The beautiful part is that there is a lovely midrash that speaks about Rabbi Akiva, who of course saw the Churban and lived through the horrors of the Roman occupation, and then finally, of course, he was killed in the most horrific way by the Romans themselves. But you remember that Rabbi Akiva, who came to become knowledgeable only at the age of 40, and then Rachel, who loved him so, sent him to learn for so many years, and when he came back, he finally rewarded her support, her forbearance, the one that who'd supported herself by doing what? The Midrash tells us that when she had no more money, remember her father disowned her, her wealthy father disowned her because she married this ignoramus shepherd boy. She cut her hair and sold her hair to support herself. And when he finally returned, she didn't have her hair. But he commissioned instead a crown built like the walls of Yerushalayim and presented to her and said, Im lo ale et Yerushalayim al rosh simchati, if I will not place Jerusalem on the head of my happiness. That is the way, literally, he treated this, and he quotes this line. That's where the idea of Yerushalayim shel Zahav comes from. It was not Naomi Shemel. It's from the Medrash, is that he built her, he commissioned a crown, Jerusalem of gold, which is the walls of Jerusalem, as a crown on her head. Beautiful romantic story, isn't it? Anyway, Im lo alet Yerushalayim al rosh simchati, and to this day we put that on top of a wedding invitation, right? We do this, we do not forget, no matter where we are, no matter how comfortable we are, we recognize where we are. And Malbim therefore says, what is simchati? No matter what successes I've had in this world, no matter what joy I've had in this world, I place Jerusalem above it. But now comes the next part. And the next part seems to make a lot of people very uncomfortable. Zechor Hashem livnei Edom. Now it makes them uncomfortable for the following reasons. We're talking here about Babylonia. How did we suddenly get Bnei Edom into the picture? Where did they come from? Now, Mitzudat does not have a problem with this. If all of this is being written, Beruach HaNevua, prophetically, he knows that there will be a Churban not once, but twice. And the second one will be by the title given to the Romans, which was Edom. Romans are not really Edomites, but we call them Edom because Herod was an Edomite, and he became governor, right, and a collaborator with the Romans. And so that became a term for the Romans. And we think, we call the galus that we're in to this day, Galut Edom, which has been going on for that long since the destruction in 70 AD. But to all of the others who think that this was written by somebody who actually lived through this, what is Edom doing in this picture? Comes the Medrash and gives us the rest of the story, and you can see it in the Medrash of Eicha. The Edomites lived on the other side of the Jordan River. They are cousins. They are the descendants of Esav. And what did they do? They aided and abetted the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. The Medrash continues and says that after the destruction, when the remnant was sent out to exile, on the way, they asked them for water, for food, and they gave them salty food. And then when they asked them for waters, they gave them these blown up skins, animal skins, but they were filled with air, not with water. And so many died of thirst on the way. Why did the Edomites help the Babylonians? Because they had one intention. And that was that the Jews would leave Eretz Yisrael and they would take over. Which is exactly what they did. Their comeuppance occurred not only a few years later. It occurred when Cyrus the Great came along. And when Cyrus the Great came along and allowed the Jews to return to their land, they were now going to be displaced and sent back to their original homeland, at which point they resisted, and Cyrus went all out to quench their rebellion and destroyed Edom completely. Now, in order for you to understand what we recur, Zechor Hashem, I am now not addressing Yerushalayim, I am not addressing the Babylonians, I'm addressing instead God Himself. Zechor Hashem, please remember God. Remember what Bnei Edom did on Yom Yerushalayim. Now we think that Yom Yerushalayim is the day that we conquered the rest of Yerushalayim. But in the language of the Tanakh, Yom Yerushalayim is the day that Jerusalem fell. It's the day that Jerusalem was destroyed. And what did they say? Ha'omrim! Notice it doesn't say she'amru, that said, but that they continue to say, aru, aru, dig it up, dig it up. Remember that the Beit HaMikdash was built on foundation of stone. You can put all the fires you want. The foundations are still there. You know that because even today, when you go to the Western Wall, you can see not only part of the wall and the foundation of the second bayit, but they've even dug low enough to find the foundations of the first bayit. There is even remnants there left of that. Of course, the Palestinians and others would like to dig it up and hide the fact that there is any suggestion that this land actually belonged to us way back when, and that they're the implants, if you like, the transplants that are there and don't belong there. Zechor Hashem livnei Edom et yom Yerushalayim ha'omrim aru, aru, dig it up until the foundation, until her foundation. In other words, they cheered it on. This is not only here. I gave you out of approximately, I don't know, about 7 to 10 different sources in the Tanakh. I chose 3. I did not give you the Hebrew original. I wanted you to see them in English so you could understand it. Ovadiah, the prophet, is a Ger Tzedek. He is a convert. Comes from Edom. And his entire chapter, you can read the whole first chapter, you can go into the Tanakh and read it, explains why Edom is going to be punished. And I simply translated this as best as I could. Because of the violence you did to your close relatives in Israel, you will be filled with shame and destroyed forever. When they were invaded, you stood aloof, refusing to help them. Foreign invaders carried off their wealth and cast lots to divide up Jerusalem, but you acted like one of Israel's enemies. You should not have gloated when they exiled your relatives to distant lands. You should not have rejoiced when the people of Judah suffered such misfortune. Mm-hmm. You should not have spoken arrogantly in that terrible time of trouble. You should not have plundered the land of Israel when they were suffering such calamity. You should not have gloated over their destruction when they were suffering such calamity. You should not have seized their wealth when they were suffering such calamity. You should not have stood at the crossroads, killing those who tried to escape. You should not have captured the survivors and handed them over in their terrible time of trouble. Can I say the same thing about the Poles?
I was just going to say that.
Huh? Can I say the same thing about the Ukrainians?
Yeah, yeah.
They were collaborators. Yechezkel, who lived through the Churban, who joined Jehoiachin, mm-hmm. in the 597 in Babylonia, who prophesied that very famous prophecy about the dry bones that will come back again and rebuild. In a chapter of chapter 35, you can read the whole chapter, it's all devoted just to Edom. I simply gave you a few verses. Your eternal hatred for the people of Israel led you to butcher them. Remember, it's from Edom that we get Amalek. Mm-hmm. When they were helpless. So they didn't just stand by, they actually butchered them. When I had already punished them for all of their sins. So when they were already down, they took advantage of it and killed off the rest. As surely as I live, says Hashem, since you show no distaste for blood, I will give you a bloodbath of your own. Your turn has come. I will make Mount Seir utterly desolate, killing off all who try to escape and any who return. I will fill your mountains with the dead. Your hills, your valleys, your ravines will be filled with people slaughtered by the sword. I will make you desolate forever. Your cities will never be rebuilt. Then you will know that I am Hashem. For you said the lands of Israel and Judah will be ours. We will take possession of them. Therefore, as surely as I live, says Hashem, I will pay back your angry deeds with my own. I will punish you for all your acts of anger and envy and hatred, and I will make myself known to Israel by what I do to you. You rejoiced at the desolation of Israel's territory. Now I will rejoice at yours. You will be wiped out, you people of Mount Seir and all who live in Edom. And Yirmiyahu, who is living in Eretz Yisrael and seeing this, devotes the 49th chapter to Edom. And this is what Hashem said, if the innocent must suffer, how much more must you? You will not go unpunished. You must drink this cup of judgment, for I have sworn by my own name, says Hashem, that Batsra will become an object of horror and a heap of ruins. Batsra was their capital. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the Zmiras of Shabbos, mm-hmm. you will see how it discusses God coming back from the vineyards where he crushed Batsra. Mm-hmm. It is the basis for the battle hymn of the Republic. Batsra will become an object of horror and a heap of ruins. It will be mocked and cursed. All its towns and villages will be desolate forever. Hashem says to Edom, I will cut you down to size among the nations. You will be despised by all. You have been deceived by the fear you inspire in others and by your own pride. You live in a rock fortress. This is crucial. I needed you to see this. Rock, because you're going to soon see about the rock. And control the mountain heights. They actually built fortresses up high on the mountains of Seir. Mm-hmm. But even if you make your nest among the peaks with the eagles, I will bring you crashing down. Now you understand why we bring Edom into this. Clearly, whoever wrote this lived through, saw what they did. Mm-hmm. Bat Bavel Hashduda, daughter of Babylonia, Hashduda, that has been ravaged. Who is the daughter of Babel? Is it the same thing as daughter of Jerusalem when we speak in Eicha? Is it the people that live in the city? Sometimes we speak about a city mm-hmm. as if it were a mother. Mm-hmm. Ir ve'embi Israel. And hence the word metropolitan. The word metro comes from the word mater. And it means the mother city. For which there are the daughters. The daughters are called suburbs. So when we speak about Jerusalem as the mother, Bat Jerusalem can mean the suburbs of Jerusalem, the townships around Jerusalem. It can mean that. But if the mother is also the mother, then it's the children that live in it are the banim or banot. Right. So the daughter of a city can also be somebody who dwells in the city. But Babel can also be the daughter of Babylonia, meaning not Babylonia itself, but the one that she gave birth to. And that might refer to the other countries that rose up afterwards. Medea, Persia. So who is he referring to? Well, I told you that Babylonia itself fell and was taken over by Persia. Later on, Persia will fall and be taken over by the Greeks, and so on and so forth. And the rest of history, right, goes on this way. But Babel Hashduda, he has lived to see Babel fall. And so he's referring to the people, the women of Babel, taken captive, ravaged. Ashrei sheyishalem lach. Happy is he, affirmed is he. How great is he that will pay you back what you had done to us. There is schadenfreude here. Simcha la'ed. He's saying, how great is the one that will pay you back what you did to us. But if that wasn't enough, comes the shocking part, which I told you, many would like to, and even I've heard, you know, I've seen some articles written that if they could, they would excise this from the Bible. Ashrei sheyochez venipetz et olelaich el hasela. Happy is the one who will grab a hold and shatter your babies against the rock. The Gemara in Gittin tells us as follows. Amar Rav Asi, Arba Kabin, and I don't know how much a kav is, but it's a rather large measure of volume, like a gallon, okay? Arba Kabin Moach Nimtzu al Evan Echat. On each stone, there were like 4 gallons of brain matter. Because what they did when they destroyed Jerusalem is just that. What the Nazis did is grabbing babies by their legs and swinging them against the walls. And I didn't bring my Tanakh with me, and I apologize, but I refer you to the 13th chapter of Yeshayahu, where he will describe the absolute atrocities that were committed. So what is this? Are we supposed to apologize for the desire for vengeance by somebody who has lived through this, who witnessed this, who would like to know that the death of innocence is not simply brushed aside under the rug of forgetfulness, but is remembered? Yes, he wants to see them get there. Comeuppance. Does it make their babies any less innocent? The answer is no. Do we want to be reduced to that level? The answer is no. Do you see, he doesn't say that he would do it, but he's perfectly happy to see. That is the argument of the Malbim, that this was written by a person who saw the conquests of Cyrus the Great. And the one that he is praising is Cyrus. Cyrus, who, wittingly or unwittingly, is taking vengeance.